It's a long passage, but it's an epic story. I didn't want to leave any of it out. In some ways, the story of Goliath and David needs no introduction, does it? It's got to be one of the most famous stories in the Bible. Many of us first heard it from a children's storybook. It must feature, I guess, in every children's Bible that there's ever been. But even if you didn't grow up with the Bible, it's one of those stories that is referenced every time there's a little guy taking on a bigger, stronger foe, isn't it? Whether it be war, or sports, or business, or politics, the phrase David and Goliath is immediately understood. And who doesn't love an underdog story? Like, who can ever forget England versus Iceland in Euro 2016? Probably one of those games that most football lovers didn't even watch. Like, what's the point? It's a foregone conclusion, right? The whole population of Iceland is about the size of one small borough in London. The country had no professional football clubs. And they were ranked 131st in the world during the last European Championships 4 years earlier. It was their first international tournament. And yet they beat England 2-1. Sorry. But they beat England. They beat England 2-1. We're fascinated by stories of victory that come against all the odds, aren't we? And yet the danger is that our familiarity with that basic theme might cause us to miss what this story of David and Goliath is all about. Because contrary to how it's commonly taught in Sunday schools, it's actually not about the great things we can achieve if only we're brave and believe like David. No, as I want to show, this is a story about God. The reality of God, the power of God, the glory of God, the salvation of God that he provides for his people who are otherwise absolutely shafted. That's what this story is about. God raises up his anointed one, an apparently weak and laughable figure who doesn't look like much, and yet through him, God rescues his people from certain doom. It's all about God. And if you're familiar with the big story of the Bible, shouldn't that start ringing a big bell in your mind? You know, where have I heard this before? It sounds familiar. God raises up his anointed one, an apparently weak and laughable figure who doesn't look like much, and yet through whom God rescues his people from certain doom. That's not only the story of David and Goliath, is it? That's the story of Jesus. That's the story of all stories. It's the one this story points to. If you're here today and you're just hoping for some motivational message to simply be like David, be bold, be strong, believe that you can achieve what no one else thought was possible, well then I'm afraid you've come to the wrong place. You might prefer to go to some bookshop and check out their self-help section. There might be a book on, I don't know, victorious underdogs or something, or how to face down the giants in your life or something like that. And it might be good, but it's not what you need when you come to church. When you come to church, surely it's because you want to know that there is a God you can turn to. That there is a God who knows me and loves me and is able to rescue me and redeem my life from the mess that I've made and rescue me from sin and death. That's what we need to know when we come to church. And for that, we need the good news of the Bible. As we learn from this story of David and Goliath, it's not about you and the person you must be. It's rather about God and what he graciously does for his wayward people. This chapter begins with the anticipation of war. Philistines on one hill, Israelites on another, and a valley in between. They're poised for war. And yet, sometimes back then, issues of war were decided not by two armies going at it, but rather by two particular chosen champions who would meet in combat between the armies. And they were like chosen representatives of their armies. And whoever won, their whole army would partake of the victory. It was a way of determining the judgment of the gods. So anyway, the Philistines had their chosen champion, Goliath. Verses 4-7 are there to spell out, this guy was invincible. He's over 9 feet tall, 9.5 feet tall. thereabouts, is an absolutely dominating figure. He has a coat of armour that weighed about 9 stone. That was just his coat of armour. Or if you prefer, 57 kilos, verse 5. The iron point of his spear shaft, that was just the head of his spear, that in itself weighed more than a stone, verse 7. And of course, he was covered in armour. He had his bronze helmet, his legs were covered in bronze too. He had a guy out front bearing his shield, end of verse 7. Goliath has the best armament a soldier could have. He's got his javelin on his back, his spear, and he's 9.5 feet tall. No wonder Goliath is the chosen champion for the Philistines. All of which begs the question, who will be the champion, the chosen champion for the Israelites? That's what verses 8 to 11 are all about. They highlight that Israel has no champion to fight for them. Should have been Saul, of course. Saul, you remember Saul, he was a head taller than any of the other Israelites. Nowhere near rivaling Goliath, but he was a big man. He was the man. He was the king. He was meant to be the one to lead God's people, both in battle and in the life of faith. And Goliath knew that. Are you not the servants of Saul? He taunts in verse 8. He ridicules Saul and he ridicules all the Israelites. I defy the ranks of Israel, he says. Give me a man, let us fight, verse 10. But there is no man. King Saul was absolutely, he was just like all the other Israelites, he was absolutely terrified, verse 11. He wasn't trusting in God. We saw back in chapter 13, he's turned away from God. And therefore, he had only one perspective, and that was what he could see with his own eyes. He and the Israelites saw Goliath and were immobilized by fear. It's the same when you and I face trouble and evil in our own day. When we feel threatened by things beyond our control, whether it be bullying or unemployment or broken relationships or cancer or bereavement or just a world seemingly out of control. When all we have is what we can see before us with our own eyes, if that's the only perspective we have, it can be terrifying. It is terrifying. We lie awake at night, full of worry and with no answers. If only we would turn to the one who does not look at the outward appearance, but rather looks at the heart. That's what we learned in chapter 16, wasn't it? It was the key verse last week, chapter 16, verse 7. The Lord does not look at the things man looks at. Man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. It is the big lesson for us readers right before we come to this story of David and Goliath. Will we see past appearances and put our hope in God? Saul did not, would not. He and all the people were debilitated by fear, and therefore Israel has no champion. And so right on cue, onto the stage comes David. As we saw in chapter 16, David, he was a nobody. He was the son of an old man from Nowhere Special, verse 12, as the Beatles once sang. He's a real nowhere man sitting in his nowhere land. That's how Bethlehem Ephrathah was thought of. The prophet Micah would later describe it as being, and I quote, too little to be among the clans of Judah. And that's where David's from, or his dad's from there. David is the son of an old guy from nowhere important. His three oldest brothers had followed Saul to war. We're not told about his other brothers. They were probably doing their leaving cert or something, I don't know. But not David. He was only a boy. When big brother Eliab was doing his leaving cert, David would have been in nappies. He was only a boy, just old enough, just about to run errands. Verse 17, come on, David, be a good boy and bring this picnic up to your big brothers in the army. So wee David, off he goes, and he arrives just as the action is about to begin. Wow, I've got to see this. And he drops his stuff and somehow races through to the front lines where he never should have been. And he hears Goliath shouting his usual defiance against God and his people. And he wants to know who this guy thinks he is, and why is everyone so scared? Little brothers can be a bit annoying, can't they? I am a little brother, so I know. David's like, Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Verse 26. I reckon I could fight him. Can you imagine how that went down? Who is that wee squirt? With his fighting talk, what does he know? His big brothers are probably trying to pretend they don't know him. Eliab is furious with him, verse 28. Why have you come here? You're going to be looking after the sheep. And David says, what have I done now? Verse 29, that's a very younger brother type thing to say, isn't it? What have I done now? I've said that a few times. I'm only talking, what have I done now? But David actually is not just talking. David is pointing people to the only one worth fearing in any situation, and that is God, the living God. As Paul would say many years later, if God is for us, who can be against us? David is a believer, and when he sees Goliath, he sees what no one else sees. With the eyes of faith, he sees that here is a giant. Yes, he's a giant, but he's utterly, utterly absurd in his defiance of the living God. He may be a giant to the Israelites, fine, but what is he to the living God? For David, it is utterly absurd that anyone should dishonor the true and living God of the Bible and not live to regret it. And he's angry to see God's honor being rubbished. How dare that Philistine defy the armies of the living God? But although David spoke truth and spoke with zeal for the Lord, he was utterly despised, wasn't he? Utterly despised by his very own. His big brother even accusing him of being wicked. Verse 28. And Goliath too took his turn to heap scorn and derision upon David. Verse 43 and 44. Come here and I'll give your flesh to the birds, he says. Now, just stand back from this now and think bigger picture, okay? Where else in the Bible do we see the Lord's anointed, the one designated to rule over God's kingdom, the one who appears to be a nobody, one who was indignant at the way in which leaders were dishonoring God, and yet one who was totally despised as a fool or worse? It's a picture of Jesus, isn't it? He appeared to be a nobody, born to no one important, born in a stable. He got angry at the pain and fear and suffering caused by evil in God's world. Mark 3, verse 5, he was among a bunch of people who couldn't care less about a man who needed healing. Oh no, don't heal him, it's the Sabbath. And Jesus was angry about that. He looked around at them. How dare you ruin God's world like that, you know? And that's David's spirit. How dare he? We see it many times in the Gospels. One day Jesus entered the temple and began driving out those who were buying and selling there. He overturned the tables of the money changers. How dare you treat my father's house like this? Jesus was zealous for the glory and honor of his Father in heaven, and that made him angry when among God's people God was actually being dishonored. David highlights this dimension of Jesus. Please don't think of Christ as being merely meek and mild. But he was despised, wasn't he? Like David, he was disowned. John chapter 7, verse 5, even his own brothers did not believe in him. Religious leaders accused him of wickedness, said he was possessed by Beelzebub. That's what they said of Jesus. He was absolutely despised. And yet, like David, he is the one whom God provided for his people to be our champion, to rescue us from certain doom. It's just the big story of the Bible, isn't it? Will we put our hope and trust in the champion that God has provided for us? It seemed absurd to put any hope in David whatsoever. It may seem absurd in this day and age to put your hope in Jesus. But as Peter says in John 6, verse 68, who else has the words of eternal life? No one. There's no other hope in the face of sin and death and hell. There's only fear. You and I need a champion to fight for us in the face of sin and death and hell. And that's why Jesus came and gave himself, as David did, to rescue God's people. He went to the cross. He did so much more than David did. He went to the cross to do for us what we could not do for ourselves, to save us from sin and death, that God may be forever glorified. Let's be clear that there's only one truly absurd thing to do. And that is to defy the living God and his anointed one. That is absurd. And it happens all around us, all the time. And sometimes it might even happen within our own number, that we do not trust the true and living God. David says, you think I'm going to be flesh for the birds? He says to Goliath. No. Goliath, you've got the menu all wrong. The Lord will hand you over to me, verse 46, and I will give the carcasses of the Philistine army to the birds of the air. And the whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. You know, the day is coming when the whole world will know that the God of the Bible, revealed in Jesus Christ, is the only true and living God. Christ will come as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And if you read Revelation 19, that day is described with some of the grotesque imagery that we get here in 1 Samuel 17 about the judgment of God and about flesh being eaten and all of that. It's pretty gross. According to Revelation 19, an angel will cry out in judgment, "Come, gather together for the great supper of God, so that you may eat the flesh of kings, generals, and mighty men, of horses and their riders, and the flesh of all people, free and slave, small and great." It's a horrific image you get in Revelation 19 about how the judgment of God will come upon all the evil in our world. And you thought the New Testament was more sanitized than the Old. It's really not. Jesus may have come once as a helpless little baby, but make no mistake, when he returns, he will come as a mighty warrior to put away evil once and for all. But on that day, all will see that God saved his people back at the cross, not by sword or spear or javelin, but rather by means of a champion who looked weak, who looked pathetic when he died on the cross. That was where the battle was actually won. Not with might, like what Goliath had, but in weakness and in death and in suffering. It may seem absurd to follow Jesus and put your hope in him, but let's hold on to this truth. As we see others defy God and the church and Jesus, let's hold on to the fact that the only truly absurd thing is to do that. And let's take our place, as at the end of the chapter, let's take our place like the armies of the Israelites who followed David to serve the Lord in the battle that is the Lord's. Let's take our place to serve the King of Kings and Lord of Lords that is Jesus Christ. To follow him knowing that he is our champion who does not fail us, does not leave us, does not forsake us, will never be defeated, will never be, though he is scorned and despised, will ultimately be the one who is exalted and honored forever and ever and ever. We want to be with him, don't we? Is there anything more foolish and absurd than defying the living God and his anointed one? God help us as we would serve him this week.